Hey, I am never wrong.
Now that I know is not true.
One of these idols is telling the truth, the others is telling a lie.
That's a lie, both of them are telling a lie.
Oh, yeah, that's how you get around it. Anyway, welcome everyone to Star Trek, 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 our continuing watch through of all of Star Trek from its inception to its very end. We are continuing on this occasion with Star Trek Discovery's Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry. No, it does not. And joining us this week, Racing, you are back once again with the ill behaviour to come and talk about some disco with us. So yes, we have just finished watching this episode, which was written by Jesse Alexander and Aaron Eli Colliette. Their only other credit for writing in all of Star Trek is Magic to Make the Sailors Men Go Mad, which is
very good episode. Ooh, so
love that one.
They sadly
my favorite season one.
Yeah, they sadly not written anything else. And this one was directed by Olatunde Osun.
I've seen that name a lot in Discovery. I felt like I did a lot of season
Olatunde Osun Sanmi. There we go. I got there. Yeah, who is directed?
He's one of the producers, showrunners now for Discovery. Or was
directed a lot. Well. Still directing, as of their last one was one of season four's like pivotal episodes. So yeah, still directing, still doing stuff for Star Trek. So yeah, good company, good directed episode. And fun fact, would you like to know? This episode has the second longest title in all of Star Trek. It is episode
by DS9.
Oh no, actually, slightly shorter than the TOS episode title for The World Is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. Yes.
Yeah. For all those people who are like, oh, Discovery's like titles are too long. It's like, they've been long since TOS, they've been long since DS9. TNG and Voyager are arguably weird for having very short titles most of the time.
Like, what's this episode called? Homeward Bound. Okay, fantastic. Has it got a dog in it? No.
All right, question. It's a little bit of quick trivia. What's the shortest episode title? Racing, I feel like you should know this.
I think I do actually know this.
Oh, is it Bound?
Nope. This one's shorter.
Is it Sim?
No.
Is there one shorter than, what, two syllables?
Yeah.
Two letters even?
Oh,
sorry?
Even shorter than that. Yeah.
One syllable. One letter. What, E2?
Yeah. E2. E squared.
That's
yeah.
two. Oh! That's two. Yeah, okay.
No, because it's a mathematical symbol. It doesn't really count.
That's still
E
a
squared.
Second character. That's still another character. But I will say yes. You are right there. Okay. But anyway, back to this episode. So, onto this episode of Lorca is an absolute dick. How did you guys find this? Racing, let's start with you. Overall thoughts on this episode?
Well, I mean, it's actually been literally years since I've watched it. Mm. Like, literally, I think the last time I watched series one of Disco was kind of like prep for when series two was about to air.
Right.
Mm. I haven't, because like even though I have series one of Disco on DVD, I haven't watched it since. So yeah, it was quite fun to revisit it. I think we kind of said like during the watch through, like it is almost a completely like different show, like even to series two of Discovery onwards, like it's so different in terms of like the tone and direction and everything. But yeah, I did weirdly enjoy it. Because it's kind of like the basic kind of plot. Well, one of the plots of the episode is problem solving. What do we do with the tardigrade? Or what is the tardigrade's deal? Like what? Like trying to figure that out. And you kind of follow along Michael, like with her xenoanthropologist hat on. Mm. Just trying to figure out, okay, what's this guy? What's his deal? It's deal or whatever. So that's really fun. And then you kind of have like the high stakes of we need to get to Korvan 2 or lots of people are going to die. And it's like, but you do get a lots of lovely, like little like character moments. So we get like a little bit of Stamets being a sassy little scientist who is done with everyone's bullshit, which is so funny. You get like a sort of bit of not quite relationship building, but kind of like, is the base that like here's the base level for where Michael and Saru are at, and then here's how it kind of grows on top of that and develops throughout the show, and that's really fun. There's really lovely scene with Michael and Tilly, the end when Tilly like kind of encourages Michael, like you should the what Giorgio like left you in her will. Like, you should just do it. And that's a really lovely note to end the episode on. So yeah. Although there is bits where it's like, oh, they did that. Especially with Landry.
Yeah.
IP. She, you know.
Rekha Sharma, we bend you.
So, but yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it more than I expected. And there's also keeping up with the Klingons. there's always like the back and forth of here's what's happening on Disco. Here's what's happening with the
There's definitely
Klingons
A and B plots going on here, like very obtusely like, and hard cut, here's the Klingon ship. How about you, Stars?
Yeah, so it's a very different show to season 2 and season 3 and season 4. It's Discovery, I feel like, is if you ever want to see an example of what just sheer change in direction, show running, talent, writing can do to a show, like, it's such a difference in tone. And even though you're using the exact same sets, they're all shot so differently, they're all lighted completely differently, everyone is acting completely differently. Like, people who ever doubt the acting on Discovery, just watch how people act around Lorca versus how they act around Pike. Yeah. It's a night and day difference. It's not just down to the writing. It is actually, like, in terms of body language, in terms of communication, in terms of how they address him versus Pike, it's a very illustrative difference. And that can make it really jarring to go back to, especially in later seasons. And I can kind of see the argument that Discovery became like the friendship show where everything is solved by the power of corporation and the power of Starfleet ideals. And that's kind of true. But the problem is that they earned that. Like, that's the thing, is like, that you get to this early season, it's like, it was not like that at all.
No.
It's a ship of dysfunction, of everyone hating each other. Everyone is having ideological conflicts. The only people who like each other, actually, are, like, Hugh and Stamets, and you wouldn't even know that, because the one thing we see between them is their kind of, like, you know, the lovely little bickering, which only is, like, heartwarming in context when you know, because I'm fairly certain you don't have the reveal that they're together until maybe the next episode. So it's a very different show to season 2, 3, and 4, but I like it nonetheless, because it's really interesting seeing where these characters go and seeing where they are here in relation to their development later, especially in relation to Saru and Burnham.
Yeah, because they're pretty much hostile, aren't they? Like, this is...
They hate each other. Like, well, maybe Burnham doesn't hate Saru. I think Burnham is in this place of... She feels contrite, but she is also driven to try and solve the problem, which means that she ignores those contrite instincts. And Saru is like, I'm trying to grieve. I'm trying to, like, have a place in my new ship after being on the Shenzhou for probably, like, 6-7 years and having an established relationship with everyone there. His captain dies. His whole life is upended. And then Burnham is in here, like, kind of sticking the wedge in and... using him not for his scientific acumen, but for his biological essentialism. And it's like, you can see why she's doing it. She's trying to solve a problem, and it's smart the way she's doing it, but she has completely removed the emotional part of the equation.
Yeah.
And that disgusts Saru. Like, Saru is such a profoundly empathetic and compassionate character, even though you don't quite understand that until, you know, as you go on. And he just sees, like, Burnham using him in this way. He's like, why are you like this? You know,
yeah,
why do I not see that this is kind of who you are, this user of people?
Burnham is definitely more the Vulcan side of her. Like, they definitely play up more the emotionless facet of Michael's past with her history with Sarek, which gets brought up later in the episode. And I think it's ultimately is Tilly that fully brings her out later in the season. Sorry, not episode, later in the season, that Tilly that brings her out of her shell a bit more and gets her to emote a bit more. But you definitely see... that whole... bit between Saru and Burnham, when he's just like, ah, we're going to try and resolve stuff, and she's like, yeah, I'm just here for your threat ganglia. She's like, you know, the equivalent of like, why are you booing? I'm right, you know. Like, she doesn't really have that connection, or maybe part
like
of
Saru
that.
Might as well have left the lab, like,
just
like insulted her in every single Kelpian insult.
I feel like that relationship is very tested at that point, and she's maybe withdrawing within her grief. She's still reeling over the fact of Giorgio, and, you know, the, having that little reminder in the parcel of the last will and testament of Philippa Giorgio arriving at her door is probably a little bit of trauma coming back there and having to deal with, you know, Lorca's bullshit as well, maybe made her kind of go like, well, I don't have friends here. And maybe she hasn't accepted Saru at
that
point.
Putting this in a box, and I'm putting the box in a drawer, and I'm shoving the drawer out an airlock, and I'm dealing with that never.
Yes. Why did you bring it back, Tilly? What did you do that for?
Yeah. So, you know what? That actually kind of draws me to one of the things I have to bring as a negative against this episode, because I like this episode quite a bit overall.
Hmm.
What I think its greatest sin is that it underutilizes some of the cast, because I know how good and fulfilling these relationships get on later to be.
Yeah.
It's like, Tilly has three scenes in this episode. She has the opening bit where she's like, you know, in the quarters with Burnham. She has the bit where she gets the mushrooms for Burnham. And then she has the final bit where she encourages her to open up the will and testament. And it's like, you don't get a lot of development with her. And it's partly because we haven't opened up to her yet. Mm-hmm. Burnham is yet to trust her and yet to allow herself to emotionally connect. But at the same time, it's like, I'm champing at the bit to know more about these other characters. And I like Burnham a lot, but it's a case of like, I know how many dimensions everyone on this crew has. I know how good all the actors are. And I'm like, yeah, but can we get to the... It's part of the problem of your entire season being one long story rather than lots of little individual ones, is that when you go back and watch the earlier parts, you're waiting to see the development happen, because what happens after the development is so much more fun, in a way. Because, you know, Burnham in season two is a much more fun character than season one, because it's, like, fun to see. It's fulfilling, you know? It's like, when do you feel best about having the food? While you're eating it? And after you've eaten it, not while you're still in the process of like trying to get it into your mouth, you know, type thing. Does that make sense? That's a weird.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Dr. Migomo, with my weird food-based metaphors.
It's like, you know, I'm eating the pasta, and the pasta is really good, but I also really want some cheesecake.
yeah, exactly.
Because I know that the cheesecake is equally as good as the pasta. Just want the
and you can't eat the cheesecake before the pasta, because then you'll ruin the pasta. Yeah.
Okay. What breed of mushroom is that, though? Is this something my tardigrade pet could eat?
Tarkay.
Prototaxis's cheesecake of a Tory.
Nice pull.
Yeah. What about you, Idol? What were your overall thoughts on this episode?
I've been a record. I always think season one's an underrated series. It's a whole journey. It's a whole kind of thing, and it has a vibe to it that no other series really does. And that turns some people off, and that's fine if you do.
Yeah.
This episode, I wasn't as keen on. For a few reasons, when I come to the review of the episode, I will. But like, one of my big things is just like, there's a lot of. I don't know, something about the way they keep cutting back between the Klingon stuff and the Starfleet stuff, and then the Klingon stuff, it feels like they're not giving either the time that they deserved.
Like, do you feel like it's breaking up the pacing?
A little bit, yeah. It feels like the Klingon stuff maybe should have been its own episode. Sorry, go on.
Like, tonally, it's very different.
Yeah.
No, like, you know, like, as I said, you've got keeping up with the Klingons, and then you've got... Discovery trying to be like, we need to figure out how the spore drive works. We need to save the miners on Korvan too. We need to, you know, it's like urgency, urgency, urgency. And then the Klingon stuff is like, we're just kind of drifting in space.
Yeah, it literally couldn't be less like,
each other.
We're kind of hungry, but I could go for it. I could wait a little bit longer.
Yeah, there was a few like details that weren't fleshed out with that whole Klingon. Like, that whole Klingon arc should have been his own episode. Like, where did T'Kuvma's ship actually come from? What's the whole generation point there? What's with these other people on this ship? Like, they've been there 6 months, but they could have just stepped out of the previous episode. Like, there was little bit of attention to detail I think could have been put there, and a bit more of... like, Voke really doesn't have any character history other than he's albino and he's there. Like, he's a bit mysterious, and
he's a true believer. Yeah, but we're not going to get some proper development on him for a little while. Yeah,
no. And I think Mary Shifo as Laurel and Kenneth Mitchell as Cole kind of do the heavy lifting.
They're
in terms
stealing
of,
it. Yeah,
yeah, setting up the sort of the scene there, because Laurel's undying devotion and Cole's just coming on with his big dig energy and going, "I fed your crew, I stole your crew, and fuck you." And
you know what? That's the thing. I have to give big props. Like, for anyone who says that the Discovery Klingons are not true Klingons, like, yes, they're very different, but if you look at Kenneth Mitchell's performance here, he could have stepped off the cast of, like, TNG or DS9. Mm. He has exactly the same kind of swagger. He's very much more in the mold of, like, a Duras or a Gowron than, say, a Martok.
Mm.
But that's fine. He's way more on that thing of, I'm going to do things smart, maybe not the whole honorable way, but guess what? The most honorable is the one who wins, my kind of thing. That's his, like, attitude toward it. And that comes across, and guess what? I fucking love his costume. His costuming is so good.
I just find, I find the Disco One Klingons, like, I don't mind the look, and I don't mind the costuming. I think it's all fine. I know some people complain that they don't look like Klingons. I'm like, that's fine. Everyone has a radical, you know, they're from the North, whatever. It's a different race of Klingons or whatever, but, I always had problems with the talking, because you've got the massive subtitles.
The prosthesis is a little bit intense.
Eating an apple at a time, and it's always a bit like that. That was always kind of off-putting for me, and it still is a little bit. And I would rather they just spoke English, rather than try and suffer through the subtitles, because I feel like I'm not paying, or like I'm trying to see past that a little bit. I don't know. It's maybe that's a me thing.
So
I don't know.
I go back and forth on this because. I play a video game series called Yakuza, and Yakuza is well known for having 30, 40 minute long cutscenes that are all in Japanese. And the thing is, like, when you first do it, you're like, okay, this is kind of impenetrable. But then, as you watch more and more of it, you start to understand specific cadences, specific tones. Yeah, Japanese, but you can start to follow the conversation and understand the emotional reality that's happening behind the words, even if you don't understand what's being said, right? And the thing is, there's nothing wrong with them speaking in Klingon. There is, however, a problem with them speaking Klingon when the prosthetics are so intense that they are hindering their ability to talk. Now, I mentioned this in the watch-on, but I'm going to say here again. I'm pretty sure that at least part of the reason is that they want to hide Shazad Latif's voice for the Voke Tyler reveal. Because if he was speaking in, say, like TNG Klingon teeth makeup, you'd be able to go, that's just Tyler's voice. Precisely, yeah.
Oh my god! And I feel like that might. Music. Sorry.
And I feel like it would have been a bit too obvious if you'd had it be that he was the only Klingon that spoke with that kind of prosthesis. And it's like, wait, why is he speaking weird? Is there something about this?
Like, why have you singled out this guy in particular? Hang on.
Precisely.
A minute.
It's like they really are committing to the bit. And to be fair, the bit when it pays off is great. It is a twist that I don't think many people saw coming, but it does hinder the moment-to-moment drama, I feel. And I can absolutely see the criticism that it does kind of kill the dramatic tension and hurts the performances when they can't speak properly.
Like, I would have given this another episode. Sorry, go.
I think it also harks back to the point about the flip-flopping between Disco and the Klingon. Because, you know, it's like once you're kind of like settled in, they're right, okay, they're Klingons, they're speaking Klingon, that's fine. And then and we're back to Discovery. And then you kind of have to, like, it takes a little bit more adjustment time. TNG and DS9, the Klingons all just spoke in English, and it was kind of assumed that they're speaking Klingon. It's just kind of like translated for the benefit or whatever. So that's the thing, like another thing why.
Okay, let's have a talk about best and worst moments. Racing, our esteemed guest this week, please give me your best and worst moments, please.
Best is kind of difficult, actually. There is bit because there's lots of little bits that I like. I think probably my favorite, even though it maybe didn't seem it in the watch along, is the final scene with Burnham and Tilly, and Tilly convinces Michael to, you know, to accept the last will and testament of Philippa, and then she like when she watches the video clip. Philippa, like, talking to her, like, it's a very beautiful scene. If incredibly gut-wrenching, and you're kind of like, yes, just kind of want to stab yourself in the chest, because that would hurt less. Because Michelle Yeoh's delivery is, like, so good, and, like, she's speaking with such
sincerity
and affection, which completely contrasts the Battle of the Binary Stars when Giorgio, like, shoves Michael in the brig, and it's just, yeah, it really hammers at home. So I'd probably say that bit. Worst, I think the bit where Landry gets KO'd.
Ah, you stole it from me.
It's quite brutal.
Landry is such a wasted character in this episode. Like,
I think that is another reason, because it feels just like she was just kind of there to be killed off.
A little bit,
For like shock value, it's that kind of like
Our main characters can die. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, it's not great.
Rekha Sharma's a great actress. Like, she's really good in, like, people haven't seen her before. She was in Battlestar Galactica. She was played, you know, I forget her character's name in that.
And, and it's not a very demanding role for her here either. She just kind of, like, goes, we need to do the thing. And it's like, she doesn't get a lot of
I'm really angry about things. Yeah.
And for some reason, she's
not a dimension. Angry tactical officer. You don't want to push my buttons because I'll punch you in the face.
She didn't have a lot of depth, really. And considering she's supposed to be a Starfleet officer, I didn't like how she was portrayed as being overly like, let's kill things and fuck things up. Like, it's a bit like,
With the gun, like, slinged over her shoulder, like, I'm going to shoot this tardigrade because I'm really pissed off.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, no, a little bit of dimension to that, where maybe she was like, look, we don't have time. I'm, you know, sorry to this thing. But that would have added a bit of needed dimension to her character. You're completely right.
She almost felt like she was supposed to be the lesson that Burnham learned, but Burnham sort of really didn't do anything to earn learning that lesson. She just watched Landry die.
But also, yeah, I don't feel like Burnham needed to learn that lesson. In case of, like, she was already kind of on the way to learning.
Kind of already there in terms of the, you know, let's not look at what this tardigrade can do. Let's look at what it actually is as a species, like as an animal. Mm. You know, like, she was already there at that point.
Mm. All right, Stars. Best and worst moment.
Oh, best. So in terms of best, I'd say I really enjoy, I guess what, anytime Wilson Cruz turns up on screen, I'm always so happy to see him. He's just such a instantly charismatic, like, presence. I'm always just like, so it's you. Just like, and his little, like, if you ever want to have a feeling, and just like, that's very classic dialogue. I almost feel like it's very classic Trek, sort of like, almost in Voyager. I could see, say, Torres and Seven having, or Torres and the Doctor having that kind of, like, conversation. And it's just, like, implying what we know, then we'll find out in the next episode. I really enjoy. I feel like where this episode really shone was just, like, the little character moments, stuff like that. The interaction between Burnham and Saru. Like you say, like, Burnham and Tilly get a lot of, like, a little bit of, like, depth here. She's not in much, but she gets enough.
Yeah.
And, like, Lorca is just such a great, like, Jason Isaacs is such a strong performer in every scene. He is just dominating it every time. And it's like, we make a joke every time he is on screen, everyone kind of, like, stops and lets him speak. Yeah. The captain is speaking.
So you're telling me your best moment of the episode was the entire episode?
No, I'm talking about the little character moments. Oh, okay. Guess what? The worst moment by far, I feel like, for me, was who saved us, child?
It's
very
funny.
Schmaltzy. It doesn't feel like it fits with the tone that they're going for, because like, you know, Discovery's going in for the like succumbing to darker instincts, allowing, you know, fear and paranoia to get to you, being manipulated by your superior officer into making dumb decisions, as we see with Stamets and also with Landry to a more extreme degree, and then to have this like Michael Bay-esque thing. It's just such a tone-deaf way of handling it. Like, I know you want to have a bit of adulation. You have to sell Lorca as a hero, because, you know, it's very easy to look back on it with the retrospect if we know he's a fucking monster, right? Mm. But at the time, you kind of understood his viewpoint a lot more. You were a lot more like, well, he is fighting a war. He is trying to save these people who are in actual dire straits. And so you kind of understood why he was pushing so hard a lot more. And to see the adulation pay off, it was like, well, look, maybe there's something to him after all. He's not 100% a dick, right? it doesn't play quite as well in retrospect, but it also just, like, yeah, it feels like such a tonal mismatch with the rest of the episode. It just doesn't feel like it fits. Idol, what about you?
Yeah, I liked my best moments, I think, is the deduction and the science. I liked the almost, okay, fair enough, we're talking about an 8-foot tall tardigrade here, but I liked the kind of accuracy to the scientific principle, if not maybe the actual science itself, that, you know, they work out this tardigrade's addicted to mushrooms, and, you know, the reason it got on the Glen was because it was after this device. It has an unfathomably large map of every system ever charted in its nipples, and they can put nipple clamps on them, and now actually I'll talk it through. Maybe this is my worst moment. No, but the
you've heard of powerful hair.
Exactly. Yeah. So I like them sort of deducing, going through the whole xenoanthropological format of it, and, you know, coming through with the science and saying, you know, this is why this thing happens, and this is what we can do. Go on.
I have to rep auto here though, because like, this actually crosses over a bit into something I was considering putting in my worst, which is that this is not something a Xeno anthropologists should be doing. Anthropology is the study of societies. This is something a xenobiologist should be doing.
Or an exobiologist.
Or whichever one you want to go. Because Star Trek flip-flop back on that. Yeah. It's like, this is a part of the... And I kind of agree with this criticism, and I have to rep Otto here because he would say the same thing. This is the Burnham has to do everything here. Where it's like, xenoanthropology is made to retroactively fit into any kind of scientific discipline it works with. So that Burnham can be involved, even though there's logically, on a ship full of scientists, there is absolutely someone who is more qualified to do this than Burnham. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted your point.
No, you're fine. I liked the attention to sort of, you know, adding the science part in a desperate situation and, you know, them solving something through that. That always tickles my brain in any Star Trek episode.
Trek doing science puzzles is the best when it's actually fun, has a proper based in, like, reality, you know, predation and prey work like that. That's how actual animals work in the wild.
And I think I've already said it, like, I didn't really like the flip-flopping between the Klingons. That's my worst moment, is just kind of the whole Klingon subplot. It just, I don't think it's needed. In hindsight, for what we know in the future, I don't think any of that was really needed. You just need to see, to get a vote, be like, oh, I'm actually a Klingon. Like, at the end of the day, like, you know, that happens, and they're at war. There's no real need for this whole, you are the torchbearer, like, because it never really pay off on it. Like, Tyler doesn't have that moment. They basically, well, spoilers for future episodes if you haven't seen them, but you know, you have that moment where Tyler is he has that moment where he reassimilates the two versions of who he is, Tyler or Voke, and then Voke just died, and that's the end of Voke's story. So they don't pay off on it.
I guess you could technically say that, like, it follows through into the T'Navik stuff in season two and that role in saving the universe, but it's a bit circuitous of a path.
It's a very long bit of payoff as well.
However,
if it was Laurel's story, that's much more interesting. Like, they focus on the wrong character there. I think it was Laurel, and, you know, Mary Chief O, like, was definitely the star of that whole section, mostly because of her eyes. Like, you look at her eyes and they do all the acting through the prosthetics.
She's so good.
Mary Chief O, freaking great casting.
Yeah,
she's so good.
She's especially, like, in, like, even in series two as well, when she's Chancellor Laurel, like, you know, she still has that kind of
gravitas,
that feral edge to her.
Or sparkle, because that's not the quite.
No, she has energy. Possible. She has, like, charisma.
She really brings something, like, to the screen. It's like, hush, Mary Chief O is speaking, you know, because she has this gravitas. That's the word I'm looking for.
She has energy, she has gravitas, she has a radar that can take you to the matriarchs. She's got it all.
She's every woman.
Okay, how about, we need a metric of rating stars, please. What are we rating this out of this week?
So, it's funny that we were just talking about Mary Chief O's eyes, because my rating for this episode... Racing Idol, how many Klingon fuck eyes in Shenzhou main engineering out of 10 would you give this episode?
Yeah, that scene was a bit weird. Just basically,
I don't know, I liked it though. Because I liked it. Because it's like, it's a bit of personal connection in the middle of an otherwise pretty dour thing about your prophecy and about fulfilling the expectations. Like, no, like, you and I have gone through some stuff. There's a connection here, and they both kind of go, yeah, maybe. Because, spoiler alert, Discovery is not so much necessarily about scientific discovery, although it is part of that. The reason it's called that is because of personal discovery, and the whole theme of season one is about connection and identity and reconciling different parts of yourself. And these two coming to an understanding in main engineering with those fuck eyes is actually kind of really important to their, like, character arc. So, Racing, how many Klingon fuck eyes in Shenzhou main engineering out of 10 would you like to give this episode? It's one of my favorites. I like
Is that a dilithium restate recrystallizer in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
Oh, God. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, God, I've lost her.
There's Morse code in that, his laughs.
Oh, God. Oh, no.
Maybe I should pick something else.
She's gone.
Idle. Okay, how many Klingon guys in Shenzhou Man Engineering?
While Racing is recovering, I'll give it a 6.5. I don't think it was the best episode. I think there's a lot of faults here with splitting it into two parts, you know, with two different stories, with Landry being a one-note character that died for shock value only, and could have done with a bit more time and attention. Are you okay now, Racing? Are we there?
I'm fine. I don't know why I just burst there. I just kind of went on.
I'm not going to say it. How many out of 10?
Redacted.
Yeah, redacted. Classified out of 10.
I would actually agree with like a 6.5. While there is good bits, there is stuff that does kind of like bring the episode down. You know, like some of the Lorca, like some of the stuff of Lorca being a dick, like he's not being a dick for the sake of it, like it's part of the episode and it's part of the story. So even while it's maybe like some of the things he does is kind of like maybe a bit uncomfortable to watch, that's the entire point. Whereas, like as mentioned, you know, the flip-flopping between the Disco and the Klingon ship and Landry just being kind of and not enough Culber. There was not enough Culber.
Yes, that
was
very small.
Seconds too few. I needed more. So yeah, I would agree. Solid six and a half.
6.5 stars.
I'm gonna be a bit more generous. I'm gonna say 7. The cutting between the Discovery stuff and the Klingon plots didn't annoy me too much. I could definitely feel a break in the pacing, and I was like, this could very easily have been split off into its own episode and been done next episode, so we just had an entirely Klingon thing from their perspective. But as it was, I enjoyed getting to see Kenneth Mitchell hammer up and, you know, being the devil on the proverbial shoulder. I enjoy Mary Schiffer anytime she shows up, and I just enjoyed like the lighting in that scene in Main Engineering was really good. And then there's just all the stuff on the Discovery I think is generally a success, where it's like a lot of good character moments, just a lot of good character development. The plot is moving forward at a decent rate. We're getting a bit more about how this season is going and what the themes are. So I'd give it a 7 out of 10. I can definitely see it's not my favorite episode of Discovery. Not by a long shot, especially because it's... In terms of the wider season, it kind of falls into... This is one of those connective episodes where, like, not a lot happens in the wider plot. It's building stuff for later on. Like it's not a pop episode, it's a build episode. So those never
like
really...
It's like a foundation.
To...
Foundation for what is
precisely.
Become.
Precisely, yeah. So it's like... It's not the most exciting, but it's like, cool. There is some competent, well-done character development going on here, and I appreciate that. So I'll give it a 7 out of 10.
Okay, so this takes this episode to an average of a 6.7. So I think that's fair between the lot of us. Last episode, Star Trek was currently rated at a 5.9. It is now a 5.8. This has lowered the rating of Star Trek a little bit more, just a touch more.
Don't worry, we're going to tank that with the next episode.
Yeah, that's going to go down a 2 on the next episode because in a couple of weeks you'll be watching our review of The Last Outpost from The Next Generation. I cannot wait. We're going to go watch this in a minute.
Our human appearances will once again shock you.
Indeed. And get those energy whips at the ready. We will see you soon. Thank you, Racing, for joining us this week. We'll hope
Thank
to get
you
back
so
very
much
soon.
For having me.
Always blessed to have Racing here.
Yep. Live long and prosper, and ta-ra.